Jeff. Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Well, it's lovely to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you as well. As you know, we are interviewing you for our issue on the transformative power of poetry. And when I learned about you and then went and visited the Poetry Vessel, it definitely felt like a very good match for what we're trying to do. So, first of all, you are, I think, formerly the Poet Laureate of Malibu, California. For those of us who might not know what a Poet Laureate is, could you explain that for us?
Sure. Yeah. So there's kind of different rungs of poet laureate. So we have city poet laureates, state poet laureates, and national poet laureates. And essentially, a laureate is the ambassador for the area for poetry. So in each, I'll speak on the city level. Each city is obviously very different, and each poet laureate role will be different. But the similarities and what we did in Malibu was it's hosting events, turning up to various events to read poems like Veterans Day. I had an event in City Hall, teaching in schools, hosting workshops. So it's essentially you're the person that's emanating the poetry and the poetry events throughout your, city and helping kind of create culture through it.
And how does one become a poet laureate?
So again, this is different. Some you apply yourself, others you're nominated. So for the Malibu Poet Laureate, it's self-application. For example, the California Poet Laureate, someone has to nominate you for the role and then it becomes selected. So in Malibu, you nominate yourself and the poetry committee votes on it. And then from the poetry committee, it goes to the arts committee to say yes or no. And then it goes to the city to say yes or no.
I see. And how long have there been poet laureates?
I'm not sure of like an exact date, but it has its roots in England. I would need to look that up.
Okay, so it's been around a while though. Okay, so this is a great place for us to start. Because you have a poet laureate. This is, there are poet laureates, as you said, at city level, state level, national level. And these are ambassadors for the art of poetry to people. Now, we don't have a, say, movie laureate, a film laureate. So, what is it about poetry, do you think, that makes it feel appropriate to give people, assign the task of being an ambassador?
Yeah, I've thought about this as well, and I thought it's quite unique. Sometimes in poetry, I sometimes feel like is rejected by the culture in various ways, or many people aren't as interested in it, or they claim to be, it's like, oh, that's, fruity and over there. And then I'm like, but it also simultaneously and perhaps paradoxically holds a really important role in that, yes, you only have poet laureates. And one of the ways I think about it is language is universally held by all of us, and poetry is available to everyone that has language. Even if you cannot write, you can still come up with poems by speaking them, and you can speak poetically. So I think there's something in the accessibility of poetry. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a range of, styles and ability levels and stuff within the art, but I just think it's the most accessible.
And so it is interesting to me. I have a friend and colleague. His name is Timothy Morton. He teaches at Rice University. His area of expertise was romanticism, particularly English romanticism. And he once told me, or I heard from him, that, in the late 1800s or when Percy Bysshe Shelley and those romantic poets around in that circle were popular, he said they were essentially the pop stars of their time. They would write poems. When a new poem came out, people would read it, people would talk about it, it would be news. And, he was contrasting that with poetry today. And I'm a publisher, so I am aware that Poetry is something that publishers publish for the love of poetry, because publishing notoriously is not a great money-making venture, but publishing poetry is even known to be difficult because the audience for poetry is quite small. So what do you think about that? The popularity of poetry a few hundred years ago versus the seeming lack of popularity for it now.
So I think what's interesting is that poetry has a very big following online. And I know that Instagram is one of the vehicles in which a lot of poets get their work out there. And the argument that it's not popular seems to fall short when we come to social media. And also, there's various ways that people are re-engaging with poetry through like poetry slams, for example. They're extremely popular. I think some of it's patience. Do people want to sit down and read and be challenged and think? And then also, are poets themselves, are we writing things that are, without needing to dumb them down, so to speak, accessible to a wider audience? Or are we playing, Wittgensteinian language games just for other poets? So there's a wide range of reasons, but as you know, we live in a world where our attention is being pulled all over the place. We're going, through video shorts. We've got Netflix. We've got all these different things available to us. A bit like meditation, poetry asks us to slow down. So when we're in a world that's going so fast, are we willing to slow down to savor it?
I think that's very true. And, it brings me to, more the heart of what our issue is about, which is there is something special about poetry as an art form that does allow it to be transformative, because, as you said, it's not superficial. You don't read a poem at a superficial level. You have to allow the poem to, I mean, the way that I think about poetry is you have to allow the poem inside. You have to find out what the poem does to you when you read it. It's, to me at least, it's not about understanding the poem as much as it is about being affected by it.
Yeah, so I go to poetry, and this is where the transformative angle is I want to be changed by the poem that I read. And this happens in at many levels. It can happen imaginatively, it happens emotionally, somatically in the body. You can feel it in your gut. And I think there's a way, and this is my argument, is that we read so much kind of prose or instructional prose, or we have conversations that are around, A leads you to B. And that way of thinking, I don't think lends itself well to poetry. And poetry, I see more as, especially a first reading, especially if I'm listening, like my wife will read it to me. I'm like, allow the poem to present itself as best as it can to you and let go of, what does this mean? I can't make sense of this. Just let it be there. And sometimes I find like the greatest joy comes from that. And this isn't to downplay the role of analysis. I love analyzing poems as well, but the first encounter, and this is so important, especially when we teach poetry to kids early on, the first encounter should be the joy of the poem. It's the same as music. I always say, if you want to teach poetry to a kid, well, read the full thing first. If you're playing a song and you keep pausing it every 3 seconds, there's no way to dance. There's no way to let it come into your body and be with it.
That's very well said. And you just mentioned your wife. I believe her name is Rachel. And I watched your video recently where you spent a week with the poem The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. It sounded like that was maybe the first time you had done that. So you were reading it, I think, every morning, every night, maybe periodically through the day. And it just struck me, what an interesting idea, because that felt like a good way to engage with a poem, to give it the space in your life and the time to really embody it. And for you to embody it, I know, I think at one point you were reciting the poem to a raven. And so I would love to hear a little bit about, how it occurred to you to do that, what the result was. Is that an experiment you're continuing with? And what do you think, how do you think that's relevant to people who might be interested in poetry?
Yeah, so there's a few things here. The reason for this, and perhaps we picked a more difficult poem to do it first because it's so long. And next time our learning is to do something shorter than The Raven. It takes about 8 to 10 minutes to read through. Again, with how a poem presents itself to you, it's to show that it changes, and the best poems, will continuously deepen. There's poems like Sailing to Byzantium by Yeats is another example that every time I go to it, something new comes up. And I also want to show through videos like that that poetry can be fun and you can be creative even in how you read it. So another example is I was sitting on my bed with Rachel and we had some love poems and we're like, okay, let's pick one. I'll read it to you, you read it to me. And then I'll read it to you again, and you read it to me again. Now, maybe that's not as interesting for someone to listen to, but each reading, I was like, okay, now you read it sarcastically. Okay, I'm gonna whisper it. Now you read it, we found different ways of reading it. And the argument is poetry can be fun, and you can find different ways to, for lack of a better term, enchant the world around you. I read The Raven to a raven, and thankfully it sat there the whole time I did it because I was like interested in how my perception changed. And I was also, I said it in the video, I really wanted the raven because there's the refrain that keeps saying nevermore to give me three syllables of crux, and it didn't. And I loved that because I was like, I'm trying to ask or contort nature into my own will, and nature is like not interested. It was humbling to not have it kind of bend to my demands. And I think that maybe that's a lesson of a poem itself. You can't bend it to your demands. It has its own living energy, like a tree.
Yes. And in his essay called The Poet, the American essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson speaks about poetry, and he has this very beautiful way of describing how, for him, poetry is where language is most alive. Poetry is where language is finding its new expressions. And he said most of the ways that we use language, he talked about them as fossilized. They're the ways that have become habitual to use language. But with poetry, novel ways of using language are emerging, and new ways of understanding the world emerge as a result. And I would also love to hear you speak about that aspect of poetry in which language itself is liberated to be different and new.
Yeah, I think Owen Barfield speaks about this, how using a word in a new context is kind of a gift to the general consciousness. And I kind of see it as you're discovering, gems within a word that maybe you didn't know existed. One of the ways in which poets love doing this is verbing the noun. And yes, when Emerson was talking about language as fossil poetry, as like every word in this argument was once a perception that led to an utterance. And we can still do that. And yes, poetry, one of the things that I go to it for and why I write it is to refresh language because it refreshes relationships with things. Now, just recently, my wife and I have been walking around a neighborhood in the evening almost every night, maybe 4 nights a week. And the other night, we decided not to do it, and she wanted to go do something on her computer. So I was like, okay, I'm going to sit and write a poem. So I wrote a poem about all the different things we had observed from a caterpillar at night to walking on the Coreopsis trail over to the cliff edge. And I'm there writing metaphors for all the different things that we did. And every metaphor for me is like, well, I didn't experience that metaphor in real time, but I created for myself and hopefully for a reader down the line a new experience out of giving metaphors to images. And one of the examples I like using is the sun is just the sun, unless we think about it more deeply. So, I can't remember which poet said it, but the sun is Achilles' shield, or the sun is being dragged across the sky by, Anubis or a scarab beetle. And then the sun refreshes and becomes alive for us again.
One of the things about language that is useful in certain contexts is that meaning does get fossilized. So that means you don't have to look at everything freshly every time you speak about it. Certain applications, that's very useful. At the same time, on the other side of that is it kind of dulls our experience of the world. And what you're saying is, I think, poetry and this kind of novel use of language that poetry lends itself to, it can reinvigorate the world. It can re-enchant the world. It can make you look again at something where maybe if you had just heard a more familiar language, you would assume you already knew and you wouldn't bother looking again.
Yeah, and this kind of brings up the idea of dead metaphors or meta. If we think in our language, in England, we say it's raining cats and dogs, and it's so ubiquitous that we just think, oh, the rain's heavy. But then you can kind of, if you stay with it long, you're like, at some point, someone saw and imagined cats and dogs falling from the air in their moment of metaphor creation. So we speak metaphorically all the time. We use so many cliches for it, but we kind of lose our ability to imagine the metaphors when it gets grooved, there's one, into the language that we use. So coming up with new metaphors allows us to kind of, to stay with the dead metaphor language, resurrect. And there's a technique, I didn't come up with a technique, but I think I coined this term poetic necromancy. It's where you take a dead metaphor and you reinvigorate it by talking either about it or expanding on it to remind us that poetic language is present in how we speak all the time. We're just not always aware of it because it's become something that we're used to.
I love that phrase. I don't know that I've heard that before. Poetic necromancy.
Yeah. I have a video on strangeness that speaks more deeply about it on our YouTube.
Okay, well, I'll have to go check that out. And so you were the poet laureate in Malibu, and you are also the founder, I believe, with your wife, of the Poetry Vessel, which is an online portal for everything poetry. You have a YouTube channel, you create videos about poetry, and I believe you are also gathering a community of poets and poetry enthusiasts online. Is that true?
It's all true.
And so what inspires you to, want to bring poetry to more people, to want to help people engage with poetry, to want to gather people together who have interest in poetry so that they can, mutually inspire each other to greater enthusiasm for poetry. Why do you feel that poetry matters? I guess that's what I want to ask. Why does poetry matter?
I have so many thoughts coming in, and my first association is Dana Joya wrote an essay, I think, in 1992 called "Can Poetry Matter?" But that's a side note. I have so many like different reasons why I'm doing this, and one, it's like, okay, there's poets out there that like community, that want to learn more, that want to learn how to use language better, become better poets, be part of a community. I also want to create a platform where people that have a passing interest, or maybe didn't even know they were fully interested in poetry, can come on board. And I experienced this during my laureateship. Sometimes people, like when I read at the Veterans Day event in Malibu, people come up to me afterwards and go, oh, it's such a shame that when I was in school, poetry, I found it so boring, but I enjoyed your poem, for example. And now I don't put that down to like, oh, it's because I'm the most incredible poet in the world. I think it's more like, well, maybe you've ignored it for so many years and you haven't had an experience of someone just reading it to you. And especially in a context, I'm speaking to veterans, I write a poem about a soldier coming back from war, something that speaks directly to them. And I experienced this over and over with I had a workshop called The Ripple Effect, and there was a 90-year-old man who would come in with his family, and he wrote his first poem ever in the workshop itself. And this says to me, it's never too late, and you never know when your hunger for it might occur. And, you know, I think there is a hunger for this special use of language and this musicality of language. And I just hope to have a platform where people feel welcome, and that the art is approachable to them. So I feel simultaneously to create something that people can approach, but also say, I also want you to improve. Because I think if we improve our language and the way in which we dialogue with each other and the way in which we open ourselves to each other, well, call me idealistic, but I think that can help build a better world.
So it's interesting. Years ago, some years ago, 20 years ago or so, I had a blog for about 5 years, which I called "Philosophy is Not a Luxury." Basically, saying that people don't necessarily think that philosophy is particularly interesting, or it doesn't have a lot of popular appeal. But the fact is, we all hold philosophical ideas, which we may or may not recognize as such, and so it's important to understand what philosophy is and how it affects you. When I was doing research for this issue, I found a book called Poetry is Not a Luxury. I think it follows along the same lines, and I think there's a parallel there that I once heard, and I think this was from the same professor at Rice, that in the Romantic era, when people wanted to express particularly subtle either philosophical or spiritual ideas, things that were not familiar everyday topics and involved a lot of subtlety, they considered, especially for spiritual ideas, they considered music to be the best medium because it didn't have words. So they were speaking about music without words, because words already have meaning. And therefore, the meaning that's encoded into the word may obscure what you're speaking about. But in terms of writing, they felt that poetry was the most powerful form for expressing subtle, particularly spiritual ideas, because part of poetry is always an amount of ambiguity. Words have ambiguity, phrases have ambiguity, as you said, the metaphor is used. You have to engage with poetry. And I think this gets back to what we opened with. I think some writing you don't really have to engage with. It's just information that goes sort of directly in. But with poetry, there's an inherent ambiguity to the meaning that means you have to think about it. You have to engage with it. You have to grapple with it a little bit, in order to receive any meaning from it. So I would love to hear you speak about the ambiguity that's inherent in poetry and why that has such a potentially transformative effect on our consciousness, on our way of seeing the world, and on our ability to express more subtle and particularly spiritual ideas.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I could start with a metaphor, like using the writer, you kind of light a candle in your own imagination. And the goal is to light that candle in the reader or the listener's imagination as well. And but the reader is a co-creator. That's the thing about poetry, is you bring your imagination to it. And it's an invitation to your imagination to open. This is why there's, I think, an ambiguity often within poems, and they're the ones that stay, because you get to be part of the co-creation of it. And for me, if someone, especially if I listen, listening to poetry is where my imagination's strongest, because I can keep my eyes closed. Every time I hear it, a new imaginative experience will arise. Now, sometimes I'm a bit more tired and maybe it's not as strong, but when I'm in that focused headspace, I can see images anew. Now, why it has a spiritual quality, I mean, without really knowing, you know, there's a mystery inherent in poetry, but there's draft behind why certain things might resonate. You know, you can use repetition, the line breaks in the right place, the use of metaphors, and all this other stuff. Think it's how language gets to the heart. And language gets to the heart usually, again, through invitation. If I'm standing here and telling you what you must think and feel and what this poem means, I don't think I'm speaking to a heart. I'm being too didactic. And I've noticed people feel sometimes compulsed to come ask, what does that poem mean to the poet? What is that poem about? And they're asking for a prose statement, some sort of fact, something to explain what it is. And I always turn the thing around and say, oh, what did it mean to you? Did it resonate with you? You know, maybe sometimes people said, I didn't really understand your poem. And, you know, oh, maybe it's so good I didn't understand it. I was like, no, maybe you just didn't enjoy it. And that's okay too. You're the receiver if you want to be, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So
No,
I'm
that's
not
good.
sure if I answered your question.
I think you definitely did. You know, what you're pointing to there at the end is the part of the ambiguity means that the reader has an invitation to construct their own understanding or to discover their own understanding, which I think is a big part of the power of it. Now, one of the other things that I do, besides publishing this magazine, is I publish books, and I have published a number of poetry books, and I continue to publish poetry books, specifically the poetry that I have published and tend to publish. The themes are more spiritual, and there's one. Well, there's a few, but there's one I'm thinking about right now. Some of these books of poetry are almost, you know, they're poems that someone wrote as they went through some kind of a awakening process, healing process, transformative process. The poems sort of become, I think they were, when they were being written, they were an opportunity to look at these transformational movements in oneself, and it was a way of processing or understanding what was happening. And then they become a record of a transformative process. And when someone else reads them, potentially they become an initiator. Either they help someone understand a process they're going through, or they might even support or initiate a process parallel to the one the poet was having. So I'm curious to hear you speak about poetry in that sense, as a transformative vehicle in that use.
Yeah, so I think there's something almost like a cartographer, something a spiritual cartographer in poetry. It doesn't necessarily have to be that, but I think it has the potential to be that. I totally agree with it being a record. And I also believe in, I think it was Kathleen Raine that said it, is she said, I don't believe a poet necessarily had the experience of what's written in the poem, except for the poem itself. And now I find this very powerful because even if you're writing about memory or you're writing, you know, as I'm walking along and observing things, it's like when it comes to constructing the poem, it is its own experience. And what I find deeply transformative, let's say in the writing process, is when you get surprised. There's something in you, maybe it's in your unconscious, maybe it comes from outside of you. You know, sometimes the origins aren't that important to me, but something comes out and you go, oh. And sometimes that feeling is, oh wow, I'm so glad that came out, and it can be really uplifting. And sometimes it's dark. It's, oh, you know, like I've had it before. I'm like, do I want to know this? I'm writing. And there's a part of me that's like, oh no, like the trip's coming on, it's rising. Like, oh no, like what's going to come out? Always worth it in the end. And so that also happens can happen for the reader of the poem, or as for me, as a reader of poetry, it's like the ones that just get that surprising, enchanting turn that makes me usually audibly, even just a small sound like, then I know something's changed.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, I write very little poetry. I write a lot. I write mostly nonfiction, but I also write fiction. I started writing fiction because an American philosopher named Richard Rorty believed that fiction was a better vehicle for the transmission of subtle ideas, because ideas could be presented within a story context that allowed for an emotional impact, where a kind of a just normal discursive essay, it doesn't have the same emotional. So I started writing fiction, and I discovered what you were just talking about, which is often much more so I find in fiction than in nonfiction, although it can happen in both. But in fiction, often my characters don't do or say the things I thought they were going to do or say. And they behave differently than I anticipated. And I find it really fascinating, and I'm glad you brought it up, because where does that come from? If a character says something that you didn't think they were going to say, where did it come from?
Right. And it's sometimes I liken it to dreams. And I read this before. I was camping in St. Ives, Cornwall, in England. We were kind of near a cliff edge and we had a thunderstorm. Incidentally, I was reading a book about lucid dreaming at the same time. So I was with my parents and my wife. They had their camper van, VW camper van. Me and my wife were in the tent. And I had read in there, don't kind of ask the origins of your dream characters in a lucid dream. They won't like it. So potentially I'm primed. And then that night I had six or seven lucid dreams. This isn't something frequent for me, but it happens, maybe every 6 months. But I had six or seven of them. And every dream character I got up to, like, where's your origins? They all look at me and they kind of almost become a little bit demonic and are like, that's not what we ask here. Like, that's not okay. And the way I'm drawing a parallel with what you were saying is that, well, you don't control all your dream characters. You're kind of like, even when you're not lucid, when you're not in control of that process at all, there's all these characters around you, and they're doing whatever it is that they're doing, and you're kind of an active participant in that world and the world of the dream characters who seem or do have their own agency. And I think, when you're writing fiction or you're writing characters, it's the same sort of thing. Your dreams, your psychodramas, and everything else are coming to life. And as you said, and maybe you probably experience this as well, whenever I'm writing fiction, which isn't too often, but then when I'm not writing it, the characters are still alive in my head and they're talking to each other and they're talking to me. And I'm like, oh, they're. At some sense, they're autonomous, a bit like your unconscious is autonomous to your conscious mind. Like there's characters that exist in there. They have their own wants and desires and needs. And are they a part of you as well? Probably, but maybe also not.
This is great because it brings up my interaction with poetry is fairly minimal. I have a lot of respect for poetry, but I haven't spent a lot of time with it. I did meet the poet David White once, and he was just an utterly enchanting human being. And he did a poetry reading, and I was mesmerized. But I do have a poet that I absolutely love, and it is the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa. And I have published one anthology of Pessoa's work. I've spent a lot of time reading him and reading about him. I find him quite mesmerizing, but it comes up because, as you probably know, he wrote under about 175 different heteronyms, which he spoke about them as actual character beings, people that wrote through him. They had names, they had histories, they interacted with each other, they wrote letters to each other. And I have always found that to be just, I don't know what that means, but it is a fascinating way to write with so many different characters coming through you and having, they say about Pessoa himself, his actual Fernando Pessoa, and then four of his other heteronyms are all independently world-class poets, and very different from each other, which feels like quite an accomplishment.
I know it, but not to the degree that I could have a high level conversation with you about it.
Well, I'm hoping to. The book that I published was by a translator named John Pedro Schwartz, and I'm hoping to speak with him for this issue. He did something interesting with that book because there's been lots of, I mean, Pessoa has been translated into English from Portuguese, and he often wrote in English. But what John wanted to do was retain the meter and rhyme. So translate from the Portuguese into the English, but retain the meter and rhyme. I hear that and it sounds impossible, but evidently he was able to do it. And I would think, and I don't know how much experience you have with poetry translation, but that's a world unto itself.
Yeah, and I think, I don't and haven't translated poems. I've read plenty of poems in translation, and I like, trying to sound out the words of the original as I look at it. One interesting thing is, like, for example, and I'm glad you brought up meter and rhyme, is like if I look at Rilke, and Rilke's translated into these free verse poems, but you look at his poems in German and they've got really strict couplet rhymes and stuff sometimes, and I'm like, oh, what do we retain or create anew, and what do we lose through the process of translation? Now, not everything, and you know this, like not everything in other languages have a direct translatable concept into another language. So whenever you're translating into English, there's always mistranslation as well. And, there's some translators try to be more invisible and some kind of creatively translate. I think Coleman Barks with Rumi's work, and Robert Bly, I think, are kind of known for being extremely, let's say, liberal with how they translate. And, there's a host of ethical and moral and thoughtful and other issues that come with that. What are you capturing through translation? It's
Yeah.
hard to put words to.
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's an interesting circumstance. Pessoa did a lot of translating of from different languages into Portuguese. And, he, by his own admission, was a, as you're describing, a fairly liberal poet because he felt like, well, you wanted to. So I think, and I'm speaking for him, but I think what he was thinking is there's a spirit to the poem, which is what you're trying to convey. The language in a different language may not convey that spirit in the same way. So it brings up the question, well, what is a poem? Is a poem the words? Is a poem the meaning? What is a poem?
To go etymologically, it's the making of something, but that's probably not a very satisfactory answer because it's so broad. Your prose writing is poetry at that level as well, just to to remind you. But I mean, it's so tempting, kind of in the kind of Emily Dickinson sense of like, I know it's a poem if I feel like the top of my head's been screwed off. And I kind of go to like, is this helpful or can we only poeticize what a poem is? People send us poems that we read on the Poetry Vessel podcast. And, one of the things is like, these are the things I tend to be attracted to, but I'm fully open to my idea of poetry being broadened by something new. And I kind of think every poem is a deepening or a expansion of the definition of poetry. I think this is another thing that Barfield said. Poetry needn't be poetry to its maker to be poetry to its reader. And you can pick up, I used to do this when I was younger. I used to read a lot of popular physics books, and I'm not sure how much would go in, when I was like 19 reading A Brief History of Time without having any kind of science grounding, but the language was always so enchanting. And I find this in lots of different disciplines. So there's something you can kind of be phenomenological and poetic in the way that you read a text, even if it is, an academic study or paper or, popular science book.
And I guess it's a lot like any art, whether it's dance or painting or anything else. The art is somehow in the relationship between the artist and the piece, whether it's a poem or a painting or a dance, and the impact it's having on the on the viewer or reader. There's something in that dance, that interaction, that is poetry,
Yeah, absolutely.
and that is a very beautiful thing. So tell me, Nathan, what is your, or maybe you don't have one, what is one of your favorite poems?
I had mentioned it earlier in the conversation. Yeats's Sailing to Byzantium is one. It's got kind of got that mythological, this dreaming, this journeying, soul journeying, and nostalgic quality that just always brings me something new. There's also, speaking of translation, The Archaic Torso of Apollo by Rilke, the Stephen Mitchell translation that has a last line that gets contentious because it says, "You must change your life," and that's didactic, but within the concept, the speaker is in dialogue with, well, Apollo, the god of poetry, his torso, and the torso is still alive and infused with something talismanic, and kind of turns to the speaker of the poem and is like, after all these observations, it's like, yeah, time for a change. That's poetry. And I think maybe I like it because it's on the nose about that idea, but I take that philosophically as an idea of what poems without having to explicitly state that, or maybe not even implicitly mean that, but there's some level of like, now you know this, now you've learned this, now you've experienced this. Something either has to or will change.
So my final question for you is about the poetry vessel. I'm a poetry enthusiast, or wanting to be a poetry enthusiast. How should I engage with the poetry vessel? How should I engage with you and with what the poetry vessel offers?
Yes, yeah, so I think that the place to start, which you already have, is the YouTube channel. We post videos every week, ranging from interviews with other poets to my wife and I sitting down and discussing a qualia of poetry. Now, sometimes this is how to, sometimes this is more philosophical and a deep chat about it. Through joining our mailing list, I send articles out to people about poetry to help expand our knowledge and also. I'm building a community, so also hosting workshops where you can come write with me, and we have so many plans for that in the future. So just to speak a little bit to this, the vessel, you know, I take this alchemically, this idea of synthesis, and that anything and everything can become a poem and can meet us within, you know, the vessel of ourselves. So one of the things that I look to encourage people to do is just to look freshly at the world. Now, what do I mean by that? I'm like, take any ordinary object, take a stone, a leaf, a tree, a bridge with graffiti on it, and look, wait, and listen to yourself as you're looking. Like, try and dissolve the boundary between you and the thing that you feel separate from. To me, when that translates and turns into language, is what becomes poetry. So, you know, there's all these different ways that you can learn, again, through the poetry vessel, that you can learn craft, that you can learn to write better. But the first stage is observation, attention, and writing.
Well, Nathan, it has been wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you for talking to us today.